Thank you, Tom. Why don't you go ahead and turn to Psalm 37, starting at verse 1, please. So tonight we're going to look at a topic that certainly is near and dear to my heart, but it probably impacts all of you out there too, and that's fretting. Looking out at the world and seeing evil prospering, and what do we do about it? So do you ever have those days where you look out at the world all around us and you get frustrated? You see people at work who seem to cheat and do things wrong, and yet they get ahead. They get that promotion that you were going for. Or maybe they get that bonus that you thought you were going to get. Maybe it's just looking around and seeing the immoral people out of some immoral Hollywood celebrity who flaunts a completely anti-God lifestyle and yet has become influential in our society. Or some politician who's pushing an agenda that just seems to be completely against God's principles. Or says all the right things, yet their life shows that it is a complete lie. Doesn't it seem to be a growing trend in the world around us? Wicked people are gaining great wealth, status, popularity, and power. They're moving into positions where they can dictate the direction of our country. Unfortunately, usually moving us further away from the timeless principles of God and towards immorality, selfishness, laziness, or just outright rejection of who God is. And sadly, we can even see this happening within the church today. The normalization of what is sin as being acceptable, seeking profit over true faith, or just the teaching of outright heresies. Maybe it's even led you to ask, or at least heard someone else ask, a question that's not so uncommon. God, why do you let bad people prosper? It's not a new question, by the way. Even the prophet Jeremiah cried out to the Lord asking, why has the way of the wicked prospered? Similar sentiments have been expressed in the Bible by people like Abraham, Job, Isaiah, Solomon, just to name a few of them. I know that despite my best efforts, sometimes I find myself falling into that frustration, and especially it seems like it's more and more prevalent to me today. And then I even find myself getting frustrated that I let myself get frustrated to begin with about it, because I know I shouldn't do that. So tonight's passage deals with this topic. It's fretting about evildoers who prosper, and more importantly, how we should live in response to that. So let's go ahead and read Psalm 37, 1 through 11 together. Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious toward wrongdoers, for they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evildoing. For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. Yet a little while, and the wicked man will be no more, and you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. But the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. David, this man after God's own heart, dealt with the very same things in his time, and like us, it made him frustrated, anxious, and even angry. David jumps right into it in the psalm. For those of us who follow God, he tells us, do not fret. Be not envious because of these kind of people. In fact, three times in the first 11 verses, he tells us, do not fret, or more literally, do not burn with anger. He then adds to that, be not envious. While the two emotions, fretting and envy, can be related, and oftentimes one can lead towards the other, they are not really the same. The Hebrew word translated as envious here is used 34 times in the Bible. So it's a topic that God kept coming back to. In Psalm 73, David discussed how he almost stumbled because he was envious of the prosperity of evildoers. In verse 22, he described the impacts of this envy upon himself as, quote, I was senseless and ignorant. I was like a beast before you. I hope no one ever describes me that way. Certainly not my wife. Please don't ever describe me that way. And I hope God never describes me that way. Senseless and ignorant, like a beast before God. David knew that to fret and be envious of the wicked robs us of the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, Faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Or worse, as he says in verse 8 of this psalm, it leads us to evil doing ourselves. Doesn't it seem rather remarkable to you that merely fretting can lead to evil doing? Sometimes we like to think of big sins as evil. It's the really big stuff. That's the evil stuff. My little sins, yeah, they're not so bad. They're not really evil. Yeah, they're wrong, but they're not really evil. But David is clear, isn't he? Fretting leads only to evil doing. If that's the result, don't you want to avoid it? Think about how easy a step it is to go from fretting to actions that are sinful. Sometimes it can even begin with very good intentions. I can think of times where I have watched others succeed through lies and deceit. Especially, no surprise here, I work in the political world, so that happens. And then what have I done in response to that? I've spread gossip about them to undermine them. The whole time I've justified my actions about them by convincing myself, well, they didn't really deserve the success. They got it through cheating and lying. They didn't deserve it. But the Bible's clear about gossip, isn't it? It can be a minor sin, but the gospel says it's a sin. No amount of self-justification on my part about the actions of the other person changes that basic reality. It's a sin. Or to put it more directly, it's evil doing. Because that's what sin is. So what are we not to fret and be envious of? Here in verse 1, it is evildoers and wrongdoers. In verse 7, it is him who prospers in his way, and the man who carries out wicked schemes. Though we aren't going to look at the rest of the chapter here tonight, later in the chapter, David gives other examples of who evildoers are. The wicked plot against the righteous and gnashes at him with his teeth. The wicked have drawn the sword and bent the bow to cast down the afflicted and the needy, to slay those who are upright in conduct. The wicked have abundance. The wicked borrows and does not pay back. The wicked spies upon the righteous and seeks to kill him. Paul described in Galatians the deeds of the flesh, in other words, evil doing, as immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these. In short, the wicked and evildoers are those who choose to reject God, his truth, and his word, and they follow their own path. And you know what? They don't even likely think of themselves as such, but it is who they are. We have to recognize that God never promised believers that we would prosper in a material sense in this world. The lives of Paul and the other apostles serve as a clear signal that believers, regardless of how strong your faith is, may in fact have a life lacking in worldly success. Or you may be stricken with poverty, illness, or even death. Look at believers today in oppressive regimes around the world. They lack job opportunities. Sometimes they can't even feed their family. They may be jailed for their faith or killed for their faith. Contrast that with non-believers around the world. They are prospering around us all the time in a material sense. We will see later in this passage what their end will be, but here in this world, they may actually succeed. David didn't just identify this problem, though, and warn us about it. He offers us instruction on how to live a life focused on God, drawn closer to God, or as John 10:10 says, a life lived more abundantly. I know for me, that's a life that I would really love to have. But sometimes my flesh gets in the way, and it draws me in the opposite direction of that. So let's look at the four commands David gives us here tonight that will help us live that life. Go with me to verse 3. Trust in the Lord and do good. So verse 3 contains two imperatives or commands that are both tied together. Trust in the Lord and do good. Interestingly, the structure in the Hebrew means they are continued admonitions for us. They are not one-time actions. They are to be ongoing in our lives. So what does it look like for us? The Hebrew word for trust denotes a level of confidence or surety. So the object of our trust matters. If you're going to have confidence or surety, that object is absolutely critical to your trust. We can put our trust in God, or we can put our trust in material things here in this world. But can you rely on those material things? Do you realize when we're envious of others' material possessions, We're putting our trust in those material possessions, not God, because that's what I'm desiring. That's what I want. Think about it this way. Have you guys, I know Mark sitting right up here in the front certainly has. Have you ever been to an Air Force Academy football game? Or maybe you've driven down I-25 and you've looked at over across the academy and you see those cadets jumping out of planes and parachuting down. Amazing sight. Awesome thing to watch, isn't it? But think about what happens before they do that. Before they even put on those parachutes, somebody has to pack that for them, right? Some jump master, some rigger has to pack that parachute for them. If that person doesn't pack it properly, or if they don't check the material in the rigging to make sure that it's functioning properly, what happens? The jumpers are literally relying on those people with their lives. If those people make a mistake, and it has happened before, unfortunately, the outcome is disastrous because of what their faith is in. They're putting their trust into something that maybe fails them. Here, we're told to trust in whom? To trust in the Lord, the only object truly worthy of our trust, right? There's nothing else you can trust in that is truly worthy of it. So why should we trust him? What is it that makes God worthy of that? Because he never changes. He always keeps his promises. He always wants the best for us, just to name three reasons. Some of the songs we sang tonight had other reasons that we can trust in the Lord. I believe David started with this command to trust in the Lord because we can't fully carry out any of these follow-on commands if we don't truly trust in the Lord. As for the doing good part, trust in the Lord and do good, right? As for doing good, it's pretty straightforward. Do good works. Isaiah wrote, "Learn to do good, seek justice, reprove the ruthless, defend the orphan, plead for the widow." When the Pharisees questioned Jesus about doing good works on the Sabbath, he healed a man and said it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Timothy said to instruct the rich to do good, be rich in good works. But be careful to note here the order of these two things. The good works follow putting our trust in the Lord. This is not legalism. This is an outflow. Those good works should be an outflow of the heart that is trusting in the Lord. So we start with trusting in the Lord. Verse 4 contains our second command tonight. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. I don't know about you, but I have struggled in the past with these kind of verses. The apparent guarantee of God granting us something if we do something specific. In this case, delight in the Lord, and he will give us the desires of our heart. For me, it's always seemed sort of transactional, putting me in control rather than God. Well, if I do this, that's going to happen. If I delight in him, then I get the desires of my heart. It seems like a transaction, like something that if I just do that, that's my result. So if I really want to take that trip of a lifetime, that trip that Susan can tell you, I've always desired to go to Israel. That's a worthy goal, right, for any Christian, to go there and walk in the Holy Land and just experience all of that. If I just delight in the Lord, is he going to give me that trip that I want? That's the way it's always felt to me and seemed to me when I've read these kind of verses. To me, it sounds a lot, when I think about it, like the false teachers we see today. You've heard them, the preachers on TV preaching the prosperity gospel, for instance. Name it and claim it. But it doesn't work that way. The truth here is that when we are truly delighting in God, then we won't seek that which is in opposition to God. Instead, we would only seek those things that align with God's nature and his desire for us, thus things that God would be willing to grant us to begin with. In other words, the desires of our heart would be for things that please God according to his will. And you know what's interesting? If you're delighting in God, he's going to change the desires of your heart as you're delighting in him. So what does delighting in the Lord look like? Though the speaker in Job 22 may have had questionable motives, if you happen to read it, he actually does a nice job outlining steps that result in our delighting in the Lord. So let me read these to you. That these were laid out in Job 22. Yield to God and be at peace with him. Receive instruction from his mouth. Establish his words in your heart. Return to the Almighty. Remove unrighteousness. Then you will delight in the Almighty. Sounds pretty easy, right? Everybody's got that. I can move on. We're done. Simple. I'm not saying that you must follow these exact steps, but for me, they illustrate a necessary requirement. To fully delight in the Lord means we have stopped demanding our own ways and our desires. We have fully submitted to Him, focused our hearts and minds on Him, and we are seeking to obey Him. My problem is, I usually only ask when I need something, and I haven't taken the time to get my heart set in that proper relationship with God. I may try to do that after I ask. I'll go to Him, I'll ask, and then I may start trying to do that afterwards. And then I wonder why God isn't giving me what I asked for when I've waited to do it. It's because my ask was not done from a right heart. I'm often too much like a child, trying to manipulate God, just like your children have manipulated you at some point. They might do what you want for a short period of time, right? They're going to be obedient, and they're going to listen, and they're going to follow along. And then the ask comes, right? They're asking you for something that they want. Sometimes that's the way I approach God. I don't know about you guys, but it's just something that I've always struggled with. I also think we should take note in verse 4 and the following verses. Who is actually doing the actions here? It's the Lord giving us the desires of our heart, right? In verse 5, God does it. In verse 6, He brings forth our righteousness. Not only should that serve to remind us to be humble, we don't get the credit for any of this, but it should continuously point us back to God, who is the source of every good thing. We should also be giving Him credit for doing everything He promises. Warren Wiersbe once said, "To enjoy the blessings and ignore the blesser is to practice idolatry." Let me say that again. To enjoy the blessings and ignore the blesser is to practice idolatry. That statement really hit me hard as I was doing this study. I'd never thought of it that way, but I've come to appreciate the simplicity of that thought. If I enjoy the blessings without giving any credit to God, I'm acting as if I deserve those blessings and I deserve the credit for what I got, right? Thus, I'm exalting myself and those blessings over God. That's what Warren Wiersbe's talking about. I have made them my idols. Oftentimes, you don't realize you're doing that. I never thought of it that way before. But that, in actuality, is what I'm doing. So our second command tonight is to delight in the Lord. Go to verse 5 for our third command. Commit your ways to the Lord. When studying Psalms, one of the things I would encourage you to do is to pay attention to the imagery used in them. The writers often used imagery to invoke not just an intellectual response in their readers, but also an emotional response. I think that's something in our culture that can be easy for us to overlook, especially when we tend to approach Bible study as a quest for knowledge and not always as a quest for true understanding. So it's easy to see the imagery, for example, in verse 2. Withering grass and fading herbs. Picture that in your mind. It's pretty easy to do. Withering grass, fading herbs. You can picture Colorado in the late summer and early fall, right? When everything starts to turn from that beautiful green that you saw early in the spring and starts to become brown all around. That grass gets dry and crunchy. You can almost hear it crunching underneath your feet. It evokes dying. It makes you feel a little sad, doesn't it? That beautiful green we started at in the spring is now brown and kind of ugly and not really all that interesting. Would you want to associate your life with that? Of course not. That kind of imagery hits us emotionally. You can feel that, right? Unfortunately, not all imagery in Psalm 37 is quite so obvious. In verse 5, I think we miss some of the impact of commit your ways because of the English translation. It's not wrong, we just miss some of the impact of it. To me, when I read a statement like commit your ways, it feels a little bit static to me. What I hear is a direction to make a decision. Commit your ways. I'm supposed to make a decision. I'm going to commit. Ready to move on. Right? I can choose to commit or I can choose not to commit. But once I make that decision, then I can then go on to the next step in the process. While there's truth to the idea that committing involves a decision, it doesn't capture the whole picture here. The Hebrew could also be translated as to roll down the pathway. What comes to your mind when you picture something rolling down a pathway? I see a boulder rolling along, bouncing down a slightly choppy, rough dirt path with sticks sticking across it that have fallen across the path, and those rocks that always seem to stick out when you're going hiking that always manage to find your toes no matter how hard you try and get around them, and they trip you. Whatever image came into your mind, I am sure it involved one common element to mine, though. Movement. You see, committing your ways is much more than a decision. It's actually an action. It is living out our faith every single day. I find it much more easy to say I have committed my ways to God than I do to actually live and carry out His work, whether that's helping others in need or sharing His word with other people or even taking the time to study and pray every single day. Those would be the actions of someone who is committing his ways to God. I also want you to note a second part of this image, the path. It's easy to take actions, right? All right, got it. I'm going to take actions. We're going down that path. But it matters what direction you're going on that path, right? To follow a path, sometimes we can follow a path that actually takes us away from the Lord. We must choose the only path that leads us home, the path laid out for us by Jesus. He led the way to the final destination, of course, heaven. But He also walked that correct path here on earth. He gave us the very example to follow. And He gave us the word so that we can study it and see that path that He followed. If you're not reading and studying His word, can you truly say you have committed your ways to Him? It never ceases to amaze me how quickly, when I am not in His word, I find myself doing the things I don't want to do. I don't know if that's happened to you. Conversely, the more time I spend in His word, the easier it is for me to stay on the path. And yes, sometimes that path is going to be bumpy. And yes, sometimes it's going to have rocks and sticks on it to trip us. But the path is clear and evident to us when we are studying His word. So after trusting in the Lord, delighting in the Lord, we're now to commit our ways to the Lord. So let's look at the final command in verse 7. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. I find the combination of resting and waiting patiently here quite interesting. The Hebrew word for rest can be translated as to grow dumb, silent, or be still. It's not just kicking back, come home, kick back for the day. I'm resting in the Lord. I'm recovering after this hard day of work that I had. It's not taking a nap so I can re-energize myself. It's an action, just not in the way that we usually think of it. It's intentionally stopping from activity, from talking, from conversations, and instead listening to God. By doing so, we can hear God, be taught by Him, and be strengthened by Him. The word for wait used in the Bible is used to define the attitude of a soul toward God. Just look at some examples of waiting in the Bible. Psalm 33:20, our soul waits for the Lord. Psalm 69:3, my eyes fail while I wait for my God. Romans 8:23, we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. Galatians 5:5, through the Spirit we wait for the hope of righteousness. The implication of their use together here is of a listening ear and a receptive heart focused on the heavenly. The other aspect of waiting patiently is to not rush into action ahead of the Lord. I'm a doer. When something needs to be done and there's nobody around that's doing it, I just want to step in and go do it. Doesn't it frustrate you sometimes going, oh man, why are we not getting this done? And so we tend to step in and do it. But God's timing is not our timing. No matter how much we try to make His timing so. If I trust in Him, why would I not wait on Him? The truth is, we show a lack of faith when we rush to act ahead of God. How often does this describe you? In this day of constant activity, bombardment of endless information and opinions, distractions from TV, and yes, our mobile devices that I always have two phones with me and an iPad, and it seems rare that I would describe myself as resting and waiting. I think now more than ever in our society, we need to be very intentional about doing this. It needs to be an action for us to stop and rest and to wait. How often do we have true silence around us, quietness in our churches, or in your daily life? I know that it's something in my life that's desperately lacking. I need to turn off the TV more. I need to put aside my two phones, my iPad, my laptop computer. Yes, I have all those things that can distract me and take my attention. I need to put that aside and just rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. What about you? What changes could you make in your daily life, in how you function every single day, that would give you time and space to rest in the Lord and to wait on Him? Think through the commands we've just studied. Trust in the Lord, delight in the Lord, commit your ways to the Lord, and rest in the Lord. Do those describe how you're living your walk with God? For me, far too often, they do not. So what changes can you make in your life that would allow you to be able to follow those commands more? Finally, I want to look at one last thing in our passage. The passage has shown us two different kinds of people: those who follow the Lord and evildoers. And it also shows us two very different kinds of outcomes for them. So let's take a minute to compare them. For those who follow him and obey his commands, here are the outcomes. Verse 4, God will give you the desires of your heart. Verse 5, God will do it. Verse 6, God will bring forth your righteousness. Verse 9, they inherit the land. Verse 11, they delight themselves in abundant prosperity. Those aren't one-time blessings, are they? Those are ongoing blessings. Those are things that God will keep giving us. Now let's compare that to the evildoers and their outcomes. Verse 2, they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Verse 9, they will be cut off. Verse 10, the wicked man will be no more. Notice that finality in their outcomes. We have these ongoing blessings. What are their outcomes? Very final and very stark. Is it really that hard a choice to make of which set of outcomes you would prefer in your life? Which future do you want? If you're not sure which of those futures is yours, then I'd encourage you to do as Hebrews 12:2 says, fix your eyes upon Jesus. He is the finish line of our path, after all. Remember that path I talked about that we're committing to? He's the finish line of it. You may not see him all the time right in front of you, but he is there. So why fret about the wicked who are prospering in this world when you look at those outcomes? God wants to give you everything. He wants to bless you if you just trust in him, delight, commit to, and rest in him. Why aren't we all doing that? Why don't we start doing that this week? But when I throw that out there, sometimes that can seem like a big challenge, right? Oh my gosh, I'm going to do all four of those commands. And sometimes you wonder, where do I start? So I wanted to close with giving you a very practical step. I'm going to invite you to join me this week in something very practical. Remember how I pointed out how David started with trust in the Lord? For us to trust in him, what does it take? We need to know him. We need to understand who he really is. So at the bottom of your outlines, I listed 7 attributes of God with verses that state it. This week, I'm going to be studying one attribute each day. I'm going to use the verses there. I will tell you, you don't have to use those attributes if you don't want to. If you're doing another study somewhere else, if you've got a daily devotional, or you're in some daily reading program, or frankly, these great songs we sang today had a whole list of attributes in them, didn't it? You can find other attributes if you want, but pick an attribute each day. Study it. I want you to meditate on that attribute during that day. Think about what it means. You can do this. I find a lot of time to do this in my life. I drive a lot. I can do it in my car, to and from work. I can do it just in quiet time at home. You can even do it in your shower if you want to, while you're taking a shower. Meditate on that attribute of God. Think about what you learn about God from that attribute. What does it tell you about who God is? Then after you've spent a little bit of time with that attribute, I want you to ask yourself some simple questions, and I put them on the bottom. You don't have to stick to these questions, but they're a guideline just to help you if you want to go through it. First question, do I truly believe that attribute describes God? It may seem weird to ask that. You may sit here and go, well, of course, I believe God's all these things. And intellectually, sometimes we can do that. But sometimes life can distract us from that, and we can lose focus, and we can doubt. So let me just give you an example. What if I said to you an attribute of God? God is a healer, right? Well, if in your life, for year after year, you have been struggling with some health thing, or somebody in your family has been struggling with some health thing, and you have been faithful to God, and you have prayed to God earnestly every single day to heal that person, and you haven't seen anything change, you might be doubting if God's a healer. That's okay. If you doubt, I want you to talk to us. Feel free to call Pastor Tony. Feel free to call myself, for that matter, and talk to us, and let's examine that together. Let's look at that, and we can open up the Word and look at that attribute. If you don't believe it, don't just move on from it. It is important for you to truly believe who God is. Because again, you're not going to trust in him if you don't believe who he is. The next question is, ask yourself, if you've seen God demonstrating that attribute in your life, the lives of people around you, or in the world around you. Because frankly, some of these attributes, God could display in actions in the world, not just in the lives of individuals. Try to think of very specific examples of where you've seen that attribute. And then what I want you to do after you've done those things is thank God for being that attribute, for being who He is. Thank Him for that, that He is that thing that you've studied, and thank Him for what Him showing you that He is that. If you do that, I want to assure you one thing. You're going to find something. It's going to become a whole lot easier to trust God if you are understanding and spending time focused on who He is. And you might even find a second thing happens. You might even find that you start delighting in God as you start focusing on who He is. And you know what? All those frets that we were warned about by David in the beginning of this chapter, all those frets are just going to fall away because they are nothing compared to who God is. Let us pray. Dear Lord, I just thank You for this passage tonight that You have given us. I thank You for what You have shown me in studying this and for the opportunity to share that with everybody tonight. And I just ask You to use Your word tonight to bless everybody who's heard it. I thank You that You are the kind of God that we can trust. That You are so amazing, so powerful, that You never change, that You are sovereign, that You love us, that You're compassionate. Lord, all the things that You are, I thank You that You are those things because You truly are the only object worthy of trust anywhere in this world. So I just ask You to be with us this week and help us to learn to trust You more, Lord, and then help us to move through and delight in You and commit our ways to You and to rest and wait for You, Lord. I just thank You so much for being who You are. In Your name, amen.